announcements. Every few months we do communion on Sunday instead of Wednesday night, and this week is the time when we'll be doing that, communion this Sunday. Women's ministry, the final meeting of the four-week study on the Holy Spirit will be this Friday. That's, wow, a couple days away at the home of Ann Rolfe. There's a flyer and directions on the welcome table. The ladies have had a great time in this study, and if you've missed it for the first three, you can come for the last one, and I know you'll be blessed. You'll have a great time. Don't feel like, oh, I'll come and I won't know anything. It's women. You know, they're close just like that. And I know you'll have a great time. It's been a neat study. The Fiesta de Libertad is this Saturday, and it's an outreach at the Bullring in Tijuana. If you'd like to help, they could use nurses, doctors, translators, clowns, face painters, hair cutters. If you ever wanted to learn to cut hair, it's a perfect opportunity. People to serve in the food booths, carnival game booths. Anyone wishing to go needs to be at the church parking lot at 6 a.m. if you want to carpool to Tijuana. Return around 8 or 9 p.m. Please bring a sack lunch and bottled water. For more information, see Jose or Janine Lopez, and they can fill you in. It's a great outreach. We're reaching out to the community and building toward a little evangelistic service, Harvest Crusade kind of thing there in the Bull Ring. And so Janine's right here. You want to stand up, Janine, in case you don't know who Janine is? Talk to her afterwards. If you're not doing anything Saturday, this would be, especially if you know Spanish or face painting, this would be a great opportunity for you. Let's see some other things. I've been away for 2 weeks, so this is all new to me if it's not to you. High school girls Bible study begins on Sundays at 9 a.m. up in the conference room. Children's church, there's a mandatory meeting for helping hands and junior helper training session on Sunday the 8th in the two-year-old room. I'm sure this is all in the bulletin. Marriage ministry is selling discount tickets to a one-day seminar called Rekindling the Romance. There's information on that. Mike and Jennifer Quesada and Lance and Carrie are going to Oregon to plant a church. And this Saturday at 5 p.m., oh no, next Saturday, August 14th, at the Quesada's home, there's a potluck. So not only are Mike and Jennifer going away, we're making them have the party at their house. And so all are welcome. There's a flyer with directions. And then the women's ministry is sponsoring a girls' movie night on Friday, August 13th at 6:30 p.m. Chick flick. They'll be watching Les Miserables, and tickets can be purchased in the bookstore. Tickets. What does that cost? Is that like for food or something? Oh, it's like $2.50 for food. Okay, I'll trust you. Just don't like charging for things, but sometimes you have to. We had a great vacation. Appreciate your prayers. Just the last 2 weeks, it was a wonderful time. But it's great to be back. I mean, honestly, as good as it feels to be out on a cruise ship in Hawaii, it feels honestly better to me to come home and to see all of you and to get back into the routine. We had a great time. We spent some time one day with the Naguras and Nakashimas and just had a wonderful time with them, showing us their new life and their kids, showing us these big old lizards called Jackson chameleons that they catch right in their tree outside. And, you know, does it change colors? And they go, yeah, when it gets mad. And this green lizard is turning black and the moms are going, put him outside. But they would hold, they'd go catch little crickets and hold them like this, and from about a foot away that tongue will come out and pull that cricket right in. And so it was a blessing. No, we had a great time, but it's good to be home. I heard that when Kurt Schoenheit spoke, they sold 14 tapes, which they let me know I've never sold that many of anything. So thanks, Kurt. That's your last chance. Well, hey, you doing anything tonight? Let's see what you can do impromptu. No, it's great to be back. And so you don't ask her, she's kind of sensitive about it, but today she found out her credit card was expired, one of them, and so the lady told her you ought to cut it up, and her finger was attached to the credit card, and so when you see her finger all wrapped up, don't say anything. She's real sensitive about it. I knew it was a good vacation because when I got today, I got into the office. We got home at midnight last night. And so I know to beat jet lag, you just come into work right away. So I came in real early this morning, and I started getting all my phone messages and everything. And it was funny. I called somebody back and got their answering machine, and I said, okay, yeah, I'm back in town, been gone for 2 weeks. Call me on my cell phone at 949, or at the office, 949. And then it hit me. This was a great vacation. I forget my own phone number. That means you got away, and that was a good thing. So it was good, but again, it's great to be back and appreciate your prayers. I also couldn't remember where we left off three Wednesday nights ago, because I remember getting into the 17th chapter of 2 Samuel, but I couldn't remember finishing it. And so we were debating it, and like, I don't think you did. I don't know if you did. And so I came down to get the tape, and I guess last week that week there was a malfunction and they didn't record the study. So whatever I said that week was kind of lost for posterity. But then we did find a videotape. So I was sitting over here in the kindergarten room watching myself on videotape going, okay. And I did finish the 17th chapter. It had to have been the Lord, because I don't remember a lot of it. I remember studying it. I just don't remember doing it. So now we've come to 2 Samuel chapter 18. If you missed chapters 14 through 17 3 weeks ago, I don't think there's any way in the world you're ever going to hear that again. There is one videotape, so if you really cared. Chapter 18, 2 Samuel. The life of David, the tragic life of David, is winding down here in this book. David had some ups and downs. Early life was great, then went through some really tough times. Saul was out to get him. Finally, the Lord delivered him the kingdom. He ends up in charge. Everything's going great. They're taking territory. They're defeating Philistines. In every way, things are cooking. It's going great. They're winning victories. And then that fateful day when David stayed home from the battle, he was just like, well, I can hire people to do this. And he stayed away. And it was on that day that he saw Bathsheba. He had an illicit involvement with her. Then, in order to cover a pregnancy, had her husband killed. After that, that baby from that union died. And from then on, his life was a mess. He began to reap the fruit that he had sown when he was younger. The fruit of just following his flesh. And it cost him, but it cost a lot of other people also. And here in this part of the book, here in 2 Samuel 18, we see what happens ultimately to his relationship with his son Absalom. Absalom had been a fiery young man. He had made some mistakes, but David, instead of disciplining his son, instead of talking to him, he cut him off from fellowship and just refused to see him. He just didn't want to deal with it, went into kind of a bitter sort of denial. And during that time, Absalom became bitter against his dad. It got worse and worse. David wanted to talk to Absalom. He just didn't. As a result, Absalom and his bitterness ended up bringing about a revolt in Israel, telling people that, you know, my dad, he's losing it. He's way out there. He's not doing what he ought to be doing. Man, if I was in charge, I could really fix this place. We could put it into shape. You know, I'd help you with your problem right now, but, you know, I'm not the king. If I was the king, things would be a lot different. And through that, he stole the hearts of the people, it says. And as a result, rather than David fighting against his own son, because David felt guilty, he knew that a lot of what Absalom was bitter about was in fact his fault. And so as a result, he chose to take the people who were with him and leave the throne and leave the kingdom and head off into the wilderness rather than stay there and fight with his own son, rather than have to live with that horror. Absalom, though, was still wanting to destroy him, was still coming after him. And so in chapter 18, it comes to a head. The children of Israel have to fight Absalom and those people who sided with him. There's no war that's worse than a civil war. There's no war that's worse than two people who are family fighting against each other. Of course, you know, I'm sure from your U.S. history, that the Civil War in our country, that we call the Civil War, the war between the states, the bloodiest, most brutal, most fatalities, more than all of our other wars put together. You know, we look at the numbers of people that are dying now in Iraq, as tragic as that is, and the numbers pale in comparison to most of our other wars. But you look at the almost 60,000 people that died in Vietnam, in all the years we were in Vietnam, and realize on our own soil, fighting against our own people, four times that many people died. It's awful. It's horrible. Civil war, brother against brother, but that's what was happening here. And it's really a bad deal. And so in verse 1, it says, David numbered the people who were with him. And he set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds. He started organizing and saying, I guess that, you know, we're going to have to defend ourselves. I can't just let Absalom wipe us all out. I've given him the throne. He's still coming. And so David divided the people up in thirds. A third of the people went under the hand of Joab. Joab, this general who had been faithful to David in a lot of ways, but Joab was also looking out for himself. He was the kind of man that war creates. When you live your life in war, when your job is killing people, it does something to you. It causes you to have sort of an insensitivity, a practicality, yes. You need people like Joab, but it's kind of like, you know, if you remember the Rambo movie where you create this killing machine and now what do you do with them? You think, oh, I'm joining the service so that I can learn life skills. And when your life skills are mainly killing people, there aren't a lot of good uses for that in civilian life. And so Joab here had been a fairly faithful general, but man, a lot of times David couldn't deal with Joab and his family because they were brutal. And in a lot of ways they were. But here Joab is in charge of a third. His brother, Abishai, had another third, and he was really a lot like Joab, not quite as clever. And the other third under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. Now, you read back a few chapters back, I think in chapter 15, Ittai comes on the scene. When David's being run out of the throne, here's this guy, Ittai the Gittite, catchy name. A Gittite was somebody from Gath. This means Ittai was a Philistine. But he had, growing up, seen probably David wipe out Goliath with a slingshot, saw him later come and battle faithfully, living there in Gath, getting the sword of Goliath and using it and so on, that he just grew up, even though he was a Philistine, he admired David. And he had come recently to serve with David, and as David saw him there, when David's running from Absalom, he goes, Ittai, what are you doing here? You're not even one of us. You're a newcomer. Why do you want to leave? And, you know, just take care of yourself, man. I don't want this to happen. But Ittai said, you know what? I'm sticking with you. I have so much respect for you that if you're going to die, I'm going to die. But you're not going to get rid of me. I'm here, and I'm here to stay. And incredible. David's so impressed by that, he puts him in charge of a third of the soldiers at this point, just... again, just a couple of chapters later. And so they divided up into thirds. And the king, in the end of verse 2, said to the people, I also will surely go out with you myself. Now maybe David's learned something. He's realized when you stay home from the battle, it's not the best thing. You need to be out in the battle. It's a nice gesture, maybe a little late, because when you look at the response, the people said, no, you don't. We don't want you to go. If we flee away, they'll not care about us. If half of us die, they won't care. But you're worth 10,000 of us now, for you are now more help to us in the city. So they acted like, oh no, David, you're too valuable. Please stay at home. The truth is, and we'll see it in a few chapters later, they just said, David, don't go out to battle. You'll be in the way. It was like, you know, your best days are behind you. Why don't you just stay back and watch what's going on? Is really what they were saying, but trying to say it in a nice way. But it was pretty cool that David, after everything he had been through, was saying, okay, I'm not going to make that mistake again. I'm going to go into the battle. Sometimes as we get older, we want to stay in the battle, and people just go, no, that's okay. Well, that's all right. If you volunteered and they won't take you, fine. But we should never get to the point where we just decide ourselves to take ourselves out of the game. Don't worry, other people will let you know when you're over the hill. In the meantime, do everything that you can. That's the admirable quality. When you're over the hill, you'll know it. You won't be able to get up. So the king said, okay, guys, whatever seems best to you, I will do. Now, isn't that an amazing statement from a king? You know how their society worked. And yet he is listening to the people and saying, hey, I'll do whatever you guys think. This shows us somewhat of David's heart. Yeah, he made mistakes, but he's this powerful guy that could have said, forget you, I'm going to battle and you're going to carry me if you have to. Instead, his attitude with the people is, I care what you think. I'm listening to what you're saying. And I'll go along with it. And every good leader has to submit to the people that they're leading. That doesn't make sense by the standards of the world. The world would say, hey, if you submit yourself, they're not going to respect you and they're going to walk all over you. But the truth is, ultimate respect comes when a leader says, you know what, I'm doing this for you. I'm a servant while I'm leading. And David is just a classic example of that. Whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, watched them go as they went out. And before they left, David told all the generals, Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, and said, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. They're going to war, and he's going, deal gently. What does that mean, to deal gently with someone who's trying to kill you? But that was his heart. And everybody, it says, heard what he had to say. So the people went out into the field of battle against Israel. Sad. And the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. The people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. It was basically guerrilla warfare. They sucked the people into the woods, and they were taking them out. And this was an amazing victory for this little band of guys that David had to take on the whole Israeli army and kill 20,000 of them. But that's what happened because God was obviously not choosing Absalom as his anointed. And someone can go to war and all the odds can be with them. And it looks like this is a piece of cake. But it's so important that we hear from the heart of God, that we know what he wants, because no victory is assured if you're not following God. And there isn't any victory that you'll be denied if you are following God, no matter what the odds are. It's why it's so important not to just figure out what you're going to do. It's why we're told in Proverbs, lean not on your own understanding. This looked easy. It looked like a no-brainer. We're looking at a building that's for sale right across the street. And when you look at the numbers, it looks clearly, and I prayed about it while we were on the cruise, didn't really get a clear answer from the Lord, but if you look at the numbers, it's like, wow, we can probably buy this building for cheaper than what our rent is, and we'll own a building. It's a nice building, a little bigger than this one. And I caught myself saying a couple of times, seems like a no-brainer. And then the Lord just spoke to my heart and said, be careful. Just because something's a no-brainer doesn't mean that's what I want to do. I don't ask you to figure out. I ask you to listen and to hear from me. And we can get ourselves in a lot of trouble when we look at the odds and go, we can't lose. The children of Israel learned that when Ai wiped them out after they took Jericho. And we just need to be careful. It's not that we're all afraid all the time. It's just, let's make sure that God's leading us when we go to battle. If he's leading you, it doesn't matter that the enemy is stronger than you. You'll win. At the same time, if he's not leading you, it doesn't matter how strong you are. He has thousands of different ways to knock you on your tail. And that's what happens here, this wipeout of a war. And Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. I don't know why. I mean, mules were something that kings would ride on in those days, and so he's probably trying to act very kingly. But remember, Absalom, it was saying, his hair that he grew, that they cut off every year, weighed several pounds. So he's riding on this mule, and his hair is flowing in the breeze. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth. So he was left hanging between heaven and earth. That's an interesting metaphor. And the mule which was under him went on. So here he is. He's riding along, hair flowing, looking like Fabio on a mule. And it catches in this tree and just yanks him right off the mule. The mule takes off, and there he is hanging there. Another reason to be thankful if you're bald. I can ride mules the rest of my life. This is never going to happen to me. No way in the world I'm going to get caught in a terebinth tree by my hair. So there he is, he's hanging there, and some guy saw it, and he came to Joab and said, "Hey, I just saw Absalom hanging by his hair in this tree." And Joab goes, "You saw him? Idiot, why didn't you kill him? Come on." He goes, "Well, you can, he's still hanging there." Yeah, here he hangs out here a lot. And so the man said, "I'm not going to kill him. You give me 1,000 shekels of silver, I wouldn't raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you, and Abishai and Ittai said, 'Beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hid from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me.'" He goes, "Joab, come on. If I killed him and David got mad, you'd pretend like you were mad. You'd go after me too. I know, that's stupid." But Joab said, "Man, I can't even hang with you. I can't linger with you." Verse 14. So he got 3 spears and stuck them into Absalom's heart while he was still alive, hanging there in the tree. And then 10 guys who worked for Joab surrounded him and struck and killed him. The 3 spears in the heart didn't do it. So these 10 guys kind of stood around and finished the job. So Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel. He goes, "That's enough." There were still a lot of people they could have wiped out, but he knew the guy they needed was Absalom. They got Absalom, so Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. There's a lot of gore in these last chapters. It's what happens when people sin, when people don't follow the Lord clearly and succinctly. You end up, it just messes everything up. So here he is. He's stabbed a bunch of times. He's bleeding all over the place. He dies. They drag him into a hole, throw rocks on him. And, you know, Absalom, that was the end of the rebellion. But it says Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance." He called the pillar after his own name, and to this day it is called Absalom's Monument. Absalom had built this giant monument to himself and named it after himself. Why this was stuck in right here is probably the irony that here's Absalom hanging by his hair. Here's Absalom killed and thrown into a ditch. Here's Absalom, a monument himself, because rocks are piled up all over him. And the author is saying, you know, it's kind of interesting. In his life, he built a monument to himself. And in his death, he becomes a monument. He creates a picture that you can't get out of your mind. And when people would ride by and see that man, see those rocks stacked up, that's Absalom's monument. Now, in this passage, it says that he did this because he didn't have any sons. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. For one thing, we know he had 3 sons, 1 daughter. He probably built the monument before he had the sons. And the idea is, I want to be remembered by something. I want to be remembered by someone. Josephus says that that was the case. Josephus, in his Antiquities, talks about this monument. Says it was 40 feet tall and made out of marble. Now, there was a monument later on, much later, that they said was the monument of Absalom, but people question it because the artwork, the style of the pillar wouldn't seem to fit with this era. It's still possible, we don't know. But Josephus definitely says, yeah, it was a 40-foot marble statue that was there. Says that Absalom built it before he had his kids. And so, again, a sad thing. Build a monument and name it after yourself. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. It just works that way. Be careful when you're building monuments. Remember, at one point, the guy who wanted to wipe out the Jews, Haman, ends up hanging on his own gallows. That which he built as something that was going to accomplish everything that he ever wanted, instead, he hung on it himself. There are a lot of people who have fallen off the monuments that they built. Don't name buildings after yourself. Don't try to create something that's in your name, because the Bible tells us, if anybody thinks he stands, take heed lest you fall. The more we can humble ourselves, the more God can exalt us. But be careful even when God exalts you and you start to take credit and you start to feel pretty good about yourself and you want to create a legacy. You want to make sure that you leave your mark. The mark that we want to leave is the mark of Jesus Christ. The mark that he left was holes in his hands, his feet, his side. That was Jesus, in his humility, gave himself and tells us to arm ourselves with the same purpose. Self-promotion will almost always lead to this ironic fall. People can't wait for you to fail when you promote yourself. It just works that way. And there's something about the pride of self-promotion that leads to the tragedy, ultimately, of these ironic monuments that you go, wow, what happened? I remember after the whole Jim and Tammy Baker thing and they fell, you could see on eBay people were selling their books and pictures and everything because it was an oddity. It was like, oh, look at this. Remember the fallen televangelist? Look what he said about this. Look what his perspective is on this. Sad when we do that, when we leave evidence of a phony life, really, of our own pride. And there we are, we're under a pile of rocks, and we really thought that one day they would all be looking up to us. But it doesn't work that way. At least it didn't for Absalom and hasn't for a lot of others. So Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run now and take the news to the king how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. This guy Ahimaaz was really excited. He's going, hey, we won the war. Let me run. He was a fast runner. He goes, let me go tell David. He'll love this. This is going to be great. Joab knew David better than that. Joab had a sneaking suspicion that David wasn't going to be really thrilled. And he probably had some mixed emotions himself because he was the guy ultimately that had killed Absalom. And so Joab said to Ahimaaz, why don't you hold off? Don't take the news today. You can tell him another day. Today you shall take no news because the king's son is dead. He's going, we better give this a little time to wear off. But Joab said to the Cushite, we don't know anything else about this Cushite. He was a foreigner who ran pretty fast, but not as fast as Ahimaaz. A Cushite would be someone from Ethiopia. And so he was a foreigner. And he was going, let's let the foreigner go and tell him. Let's send him off to run. Joab, just a horrible person to say, I don't want you to do it because I like you. I'll pick you and you go tell David. Really, for a guy who was a courageous warrior, he was also kind of a coward because he didn't want the word to get to David in any way that would cause him danger. He was a politician. So this poor Cushite, he says, okay, I'll go. And so Joab said to him, go tell the king what you've seen. So the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. He goes, fine. Ahimaaz goes, I want to go too. Whatever happens, let me run after the Cushite. He's already going to be there. And Joab said, what do you want to run for? You've got no news. The news will already be there. He goes, whatever happens, let me run. He just goes, I feel like running. So he goes, okay, fine, run. I never understand people that just want to run for no reason. There's no message to take. It's already going to be there. Somebody else has a head start. You're not going to win. What are you running for? I often see in the Olympics when the last place guy in the marathon is coming in just, he's from Samoa or somewhere that's not known for runners, and you're just going, wow, you're the best distance runner in Samoa, but you guys aren't very good. You didn't have a chance like that bobsled team that they made that movie about. It's like, come on, you don't, from Jamaica, you don't have a chance. Oh, but it's just the running. I just want to run. I don't get it. You train for 4 years to make the Olympic team knowing you don't have a chance to win. Oh, I can see if you have a chance to win, go for it. But if you know you don't have a chance to win, I think, you could sit around and eat Krispy Kreme donuts and come in last. What's the deal, But Ahimaaz was one of those kind of guys, one of these runners that we just don't understand. And he just had to go. And he ran so fast, he ended up passing up the Cushite. David was sitting there, and he sees some guy running by himself, and the watchman said, hey, I see a guy running way off in the distance. And David goes, oh, it's got to be good news. It's just one guy. If I saw the whole army running, I'd be concerned, but it's one guy. It's news. It's like, yeah, this is a news flash. And so he goes, the watchman goes, hey, there's another guy running, and he's catching up. And he goes, oh, great, he must also be brain news. And the watchman said, verse 27, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz. This guy must have run in a particular way and, maybe a certain strut or something. And he goes, man, I've never seen anybody run that fast. I think it's Ahimaaz. So Ahimaaz gets there first, and he said, all is well, verse 28. Bowed down before the king, and then he started getting nervous. He was like, I don't know if I want to give this news or not. Blessed be the Lord your God who has delivered up the men who raised their hands against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, Joab just sent me here. There was a lot of commotion. I don't really know what happened. And the king said, okay, wait right here. Maybe this other guy will know. So this poor Cushite comes and says, good news for my lord the king. The Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? And the Cushite doesn't get it. He hasn't been around. He's a foreigner. He goes, oh, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. He blurts it out like, oh yeah, boy, is he ever dead, and I hope everyone else that comes against you is dead. David wasn't thrilled. I'm amazed that he didn't kill the Cushite, but no point in shooting the mailman. He just instead was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate, this little private room at the top of the gate, and he wept. And as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. We looked at this passage in the next few verses a few Sunday mornings ago, so I won't go into it in detail, but David is now mourning and weeping because, not just because Absalom was dead, but I'm sure he was living with the guilt of being partially responsible, the regret of never really restoring his relationship with him, the realization that this was an attack from within, not without. And here, this has happened. He probably also kind of realized that his generals weren't really honoring what his wishes were also. For a lot of reasons, David was just devastated, and he was weeping openly, and everyone knew it. So we see as the people came back, they were afraid. They were all, woohoo, you know, we won. And then they hear, hey, David's, they hear him weeping loudly, my son Absalom. And they were probably thinking, come on, we lost 20,000 people. Absalom was trying to kill you. What are you thinking? But they couldn't say that to the king, so they just, okay, I guess we're not happy. And they just went home. Joab sees the situation, and he realized the tenuous nature of the kingdom. Remember, these people had just run David out of town. A lot of them did, most of them did. And the ones who hadn't had loyally stuck by him when he was run out of town. And so it's like, hey, all these people, this is kind of sensitive. Of course, Joab was also worried that he would be in trouble. And so he went in and gave a little pep talk to David and had a lot of good advice. Joab came in, verse 5, and said, today you've disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and you hate your friends. He's saying, David, you don't know who your friends are. Absalom's been nothing but trouble for you. I've been loyal to you. We all have. We love you. We laid our lives on the line for you while you were sitting back here. Come on, you're weeping for Absalom. If we were dead, you'd rather have us dead and have Absalom still alive. And so he goes through this talk and he said, now therefore, on the basis of this, get up and go out and speak comfort to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you don't go out, not one will stay with you this night, and that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. Challenge David to his responsibilities as a leader. And again, I went into this on Sunday morning a few weeks ago, and won't spend a lot of time on it again, but just to say this, there are times when you as a leader, you just have to step up. And you may not feel like it. You know, I know I was talking to Kevin. They just had their new little girl, their little baby. And I said, you getting much sleep? Well, I can tell, not as much as he would like. But you're laying there in bed and the kid's crying. What are you going to do? I mean, you just have to do it. Look, you're the mom. You're the dad. Go take care of this. Deal with it. There are certain things that you have to do. You may be afraid of blood. You may hate the sight of injury. But when your child is hurt and you're the one that's there, you can't just go, ah, and run away. You can't just go, okay, I don't want to see it. I don't want to know. No, you step up and you deal with it whether you like it or not. As a parent, When your kids are growing up, you touch things that you would never touch otherwise for anyone else, for anyone else's kid. You're changing diapers and you're getting squirted and you're thinking it's funny. Nobody else is going to get away with doing that to you, but it's your kid. You've got to step up. And it's true for every leader, not just for parents, but people leading in any capacity. The time comes when you have to choose. You're either going to be selfish and cowardly, or you're going to decide that somebody's going to have to do it, and so I think it better be me. And no matter how you feel, and no matter what you've gone through this week, no matter how tired or exhausted you might be, you've just got to suck it up and go for it. And Joab gave David a great reminder of this, and Joab was this kind of guy. Hey, if there's time to fight, I'm going to fight. I don't care if I've been fighting all day. I don't care if I'm hungry. I don't care I would much rather go take a snooze. I'm a soldier. It's time to go, we go. And so he gives this talk to David. It seems kind of insensitive. David more devastated than he had ever been, as far as we know, in his life. He's just come to the end of his rope. But a good friend sometimes will tell you, you're not really at the end. You can do this. Come on, get back up and keep moving. I'm not going to leave you here. I'm not going to let this happen. It's going to cost you severely if you don't get yourself together and get back in the horse. Personally, I think, I wonder how much better off we would be if that was what we always gave for marriage counseling. A couple comes in for counseling, and they're just going, I'm so unhappy. She's just so brutal to me. He's so mean. They're awful. My life is miserable. It stinks. It feels like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. It's just, my life is terrible. And a counselor goes, hey, welcome to marriage. Get back in there. You go love your wife, love your husband, do what God has told you to do. It sounds really brutal and mean, but it may not be a bad piece of advice. I'm certain our society would be better off if instead of comforting people who are going through hard times, we would say, yeah, that's life. I've told the story before, but Anne reminded me of it when we were over in Hawaii out at the Pali Lookout where there's really strong winds blowing. And we were years ago when we were there. I saw this. We were walking out to look out, and there's this family who's walking back after the lookout, and with the wind and everything, hair just a mess, and they had like 5 or 6 kids running all over the place, all out of control, and it just looked bad. And the man had a T-shirt on. I'll never forget it. And it said he had the saddest look on his face, and his T-shirt said, "Marriage is not funny." And it was funny to me. But I only have 2 kids, so it's easy for me to say. But, so often, what you need to realize is, we're in a battle. Life's not that long. You can do it. You can pull yourself together. You can depend on the Lord. Reach out to Him. Don't quit. Come on, get back out there. And I think we would probably be more helped by people who lovingly, gently, but firmly let us realize, let us recognize the price of our quitting and realize, yeah, you may feel bad because you don't have a job, but if you don't go out and look for a job, you're not going to have a job tomorrow either. It's going to get a lot worse. And so just this gentle prodding by Joab, I like it. It was good. And he was right. David was going to lose the kingdom. People would have died. 20,000 people would have died in vain if he didn't start acting like a leader. And sometimes we just need to be told, act like a leader, be a man, step up, do what you need to do. And so he said that, and the king arose, and he sat in the gate. He went where everyone was, made himself accessible, and they told all the people, hey, there's the king, he's sitting in the gate. So all the people came before the king, for every one of Israel had fled to his tent. You may think that the best way to comfort yourself is to be by yourself. It's one of the lies of Satan. The truth is, if you'll force yourself to be around people when you're going through a hard time, you'll always end up feeling better. Oh, maybe not right at first. Right at first, everything that everyone else has is a reminder to you of what you don't have. But ultimately, it's being with the body. It's being with family. That's what helps us to pull out of sometimes these death spirals that we find ourselves in. And so David went out, as Joab suggested, and he just started talking to the people and being with them. And everyone didn't know what was going on. In verse 9, everybody was fighting. There was this problem, basically, here in most of the rest of the chapter, where everyone's going, well, what do we do now? I mean, we just threw David out, many of us. The ones who went out with him, hey, we were just tossed out. These people are going, we elected Absalom as our king, and now he's dead. What do we do? Go with the next choice? What do we do? Just decide, hey, David, we're always kind of hoping you would win anyway. And it's like, it's funny, after a political campaign, the party that loses, they get the stickers off their bumpers right away. They just go, you know, I don't even want to be a part of this. In fact, it's amazing how people actually change their vote after the fact, one way or the other. If things aren't going well, you know, it would have been much better if that Florida recount had been done properly and now we would have Al Gore as a president. You know, people who voted for Bush, come on, most of the people voted for Bush most of the time, and I know popular vote, maybe Gore won, we don't know. But the point is, after the fact, people change their minds, historical revisionism. It takes a courageous person to stand up and say, you know what, I was wrong, but I did it. That was me. And at the same time, to graciously say, but hey, let's make the best of this. What's our attitude going to be like if someone is elected president in November that we don't like, that we don't want? And it could be of either party, it doesn't matter. Are we going to say, you know what, this is America, this is the way our system worked, and we have the president and vice president that God wants us to have? Do we believe that? Or do we panic? Oh man, if our guy doesn't win, oh, what's going to happen? It doesn't matter if our guy wins. It doesn't matter who our guy is. The truth is, God's the one who takes care of us. He gives us leaders, unfortunately, sometimes that we deserve. That frightens me very seriously. But at the same time, we're a nation that needs to stick together. And during an election year, boy, we hear a lot of talk about, we're just one nation. But each person is claiming that they're the one that owns the nation. Ralph Nader must think that he is the guy. I can't figure that out, but probably all sorts of other people. You know, back when we were electing a new governor, and we had like 106 people running for governor, page after page of all, and sure, all of them, I don't think Gary Coleman thought he was going to win, but all this ambition, and you have this deal of, what do you do after it's over? How do you pull the nation back together? You build your whole existence on the basis of arguing with each other, of fighting and rebelling, and now what? Here we are. We only have one king left, and he's the one we just chased out of town. And so the people were arguing over who's going to do what, and somebody ought to talk to David. We really ought to invite him to come back, but this is sort of embarrassing. And it would be like if California right now recalled Arnold Schwarzenegger and tried to get Gray Davis to be the governor again. You just go, well, this is kind of an unusual and uncomfortable situation. So they didn't know what to do. Then they start arguing. Finally, they go, David himself goes, is anybody going to ask me to come back? And the people in the northern tribes, remember, he was from the tribe of Judah in the south. People in the northern tribe jumped on it first and go, come on, let's make David our king. Okay, we were wrong. Absalom, he turned out to be kind of a jerk. And hey, let's start over. Let's have David back. Long live the king. And he heard that and he says to Judah, he goes, you guys are my neighbors. You're my brothers. How come they're asking first? So then the northern tribe started saying to Judah, you guys are nothing, man. He's your guy, but we're the ones that ask him to come back first. And Judah's going, no, he's more our king than he is your king because he's of the tribe of Judah. He's a southerner. Don't ever forget that. They were arguing. So they're having this skirmish back and forth. And it gets heated more and more. Finally, they do invite him to come on back. And a bunch of people from the tribe of Benjamin and from other tribes come back with him. Even this guy Shimei, who had been yelling for his head, came back. Everyone's acting like, oh, we're all happy. Shimei came in verse 18 and fell down before the king. Remember the last time we met, Shimei was the guy who was saying, you deserve to die, you big loser, as David was leaving town. Well, now he comes back and goes, oh, remember what I said before? Never mind. Everything's fine. And so Abishai wants to kill him, and David goes, hey, no way, I'm becoming king today. I'm not going to kill anybody. Don't worry about it. He said he was sorry. And so the king swore to him in verse 23 that he wouldn't die. Then here he is. He's riding back into town. Here comes Mephibosheth. You remember Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan. that when Saul was overthrown and David ended up becoming king, Mephibosheth, the young son of Jonathan, David's best friend, Saul's son, this is Saul's grandson, had been dropped by his maid who was trying to carry him out, and he was handicapped as a result of it. But David, in wanting to reach out to Jonathan because of the deal they had, had taken Mephibosheth, given him back all of his grandfather's land, took him into his own house, said, "You're going to eat at my table from now on." Well, years went by, and there was this guy who, a servant who was overseeing the estate for him, basically. And you might remember, he had come to David, and David goes, "Hey, what happened to Mephibosheth?" And Mephibosheth's servant said, "Oh, you know, he didn't support you at all." And so David goes, "Well, fine. If he doesn't support me, then you can have all his stuff." And that's exactly what the servant really wanted to happen, and apparently. But you never know, because now David and Mephibosheth meet, and David goes, "Hey, where were you, Mephibosheth?" Mephibosheth was all messed up, hair messed up, all dirty and grungy, and just looking like a pig. And maybe because his servant had split, but he said, "Man, I couldn't get going. Nobody would take me. I wanted to come with you. I just couldn't do it." And David said, "Well, whatever. It doesn't matter. Why do you speak any more of these matters? You and Ziba divide the land." The servant Ziba had been given the land by David when Ziba told David that Mephibosheth had turned on him. Now Mephibosheth is saying, "No, it's Ziba. He's lying." David just goes, "Whatever. You guys divide it up. Just split it up." And got rid of that. And so Mephibosheth makes you think in verse 30 that maybe he was a good guy, because he said to the king, "No, let Ziba have it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." So he at least seems like he was like, "David, I'm just glad you're back home. I don't care about my grandfather's fields and money and everything. That doesn't even matter to me." So it could be that Ziba was the creep. It could be Mephibosheth was. We don't really know. Then David, as he comes back under control, he shows kindness to Barzillel in the Gileadite. And he was a real old guy. Well, 80. 80 doesn't sound as old to me as it used to. 50 used to sound old, but not anymore. But it says he was old, very aged, 80 years old. And he had helped David before. So David's going, "Hey, come on back with me." So we see through in those next through verses, Barzillel said to David, "You know what, I'm an old guy, I'm not going to do you any good. Take some of the younger guys back with you. You don't need to reward me, I'm fine." So he went with him and then just said, "I'm going back home," and so he did. Then the people are fighting still. The king, verse 40, went on to Gilgal, and Chinnam went on with him, and all the people of Judah escorted the king and half the people of Israel. Just then all the men of Israel, the northern tribes, came to the king and said to him, "Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan?" They're going, "How come you're letting Judah host the big potluck for you as you've come back into the land?" And the guys from Judah said, "Hey, come on, the king is a close relative of ours. He is from the tribe of Judah, maybe you haven't noticed. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? It's potluck, no big deal." The men of Israel were going, "Yeah, but when you guys were still rejecting him, we have 10 shares of the king. There's 10 tribes of us. It's only just you, Judah, and Benjamin. And so we have more right to David than you. Why do you despise us? Weren't we the first to advise bringing back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel." So here, God has done this, given him this victory. The nation is again united. God's man David is back on the throne. And what happens? The people are fighting among themselves, jockeying for position. Instead of in humility going, "What were we thinking? This was awful. We're so glad David's back." Instead, they're going, "Yeah, he's back and we're in charge. We're going to take over." These people are showing the same heart that Absalom showed when he started this whole mess. Actually, sadly, the attitude that David had as he selfishly looked out for himself and thought of other people's lives as being disposable and dispensable, they pick up this attitude and now they're fighting among themselves. It's always a bad thing when brothers and sisters, when Christians fight among themselves, start to jockey for position. I'm amazed sometimes to see what happens when someone, you know, opens a church that's too close to another church. And there's always this attitude, you're moving into my territory, you're taking my sheep. And it's like, come on, wait a minute, I thought we were brothers. I'm not going to fight you over territory. I'm not going to fight over sheep. That doesn't make sense. Aren't they his sheep? Does it really matter? And yet some of the best fights you'll ever have in your life are fights with your brothers, fights with the family. It's amazing. Instead of exerting our energy toward seeking the lost, toward fighting against the influence of Satan, you've heard it said many times, the Christian army is the only army that shoots its wounded. The truth is, I don't think that's fair. There are a whole lot of armies that shoot their wounded, including both political parties, including all sorts of other groups. They'll turn on you so fast when things aren't going your way. But here, as is the case often in our lives, people fighting among themselves when they're supposed to be on the same side. The result in chapter 20 is the rebellion of Sheba. There was a guy named Sheba who's going, hey, if Judah's going to be so strong, I'm going to take over in the northern tribes. I'm going to do this. So he blew a trumpet and he got everyone to say, we have no share in David. He didn't want to be our king. He doesn't care about us. We don't have an inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So the people from the north deserted David and followed Sheba. The men of Judah from Jordan as far as Jerusalem stayed loyal to their king. So again, a divided kingdom. Now as we read on in the chapter, the king said to Amasa, by the way, Amasa was the general that worked with Absalom. Amasa, when David was rallying the troops in the previous chapter, he called out in order to draw the people to himself, he goes, I'll make Amasa the general instead of Joab. Joab's been my general, but I'll take Absalom's guy, Amasa, and I'll put him in charge if we can put this kingdom together. It's kind of a compromise, kind of working a deal. And so now he's made Amasa the head general. And so he gets Amasa and says, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. He goes, get an army together and I need them in 3 days. But 3 days they hadn't shown up. He went to assemble them, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. And so David goes to Abishai. You know what? He hasn't done this. Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. This is going to be worse than Absalom if we just let this guy go. We let Sheba continue in his rebellion. So Joab's men went out after him, went out to Jerusalem to pursue Sheba. In the meantime, Amasa's trying to get the troops together. He's been given an order, but he didn't do it in time. It's important to be on time when the opportunity comes to be ready to take it. Here's a guy who just didn't hustle. And as a result, he ends up losing not only his command, but his life. Because as we read on, Amasa finally catches up with his troops. Joab's already out in the lead. Joab goes, Amasa, how you doing? He has a knife in his belt. He bends over and it accidentally falls out. He goes to pick it up. He palms it in his hand. He goes to hug Amasa and he stabs him and kills him. He's like, sorry, you snooze, you lose. He, at that point, decommissioned Amasa as the new general, and Joab is again the general. He asked him in verse 9, are you in good health? Took him by the beard to kiss him. Amasa didn't notice the sword that was in Joab's hand. This tips you off, Amasa wasn't the greatest fighting man ever, if he's letting this guy kiss him with a knife in his hand. But he struck him with it in the stomach and his he killed him. And one of those verses is great for kids to read. They love that kind of stuff. Junior high kids, this would be like their life verse. But meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever's for David, follow Joab. They go, you know what? Forget Amasa. He's laying here on the ground. Things aren't looking good for him. Let's go. So they end up kicking Amasa to the side, pushed him off the road, and everybody took off with Joab. They went ahead and came and chased down Sheba. And there was this wise woman there in the city where Sheba was hiding out in Abel of Beth-Maach. And a woman came out and said to Joab, look, come here, let me talk to you. He goes, okay, what do you want to say? She goes, there's no point in you coming in and wiping out this city and killing everybody. Sheba's the guy you want. You don't want all these other people. So tell you what, wait outside the city. We'll toss his head out to you. Everything will be fine. And so then he goes, fine, toss his head out. With no point in destroying the city. So she goes back in, tells the men of the city, you guys were in trouble, Joab's out here with an army. I cut a deal for you, a little plea bargain. All we have to do is give up Sheba, and everything's fine. So they go, hey, great with us. We'll save our city. They hack Sheba's head off, toss it over the side. Joab says, okay, we're fine, and he leaves. Again, another one of those, you know, it says, the woman in her wisdom went to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, verse 22, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Then he blew a trumpet. That wasn't Sheba that blew the trumpet after he was beheaded. It was Joab. And they left, and every man went to his tent, and Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. And then it tells the guys that David then put in charge as he's setting up his kingdom again. Again, it's just, it's awful. It gets worse. In fact, chapter 21, there's a famine in the land. Things were going bad for 3 years, year after year. David finally prays about it, and God told him, you know, it's because of Saul when he wiped out the Gibeonites. They were commanded not to touch the Gibeonites, to leave them alone. Saul had gone in and butchered the Gibeonites, and now the Lord says, that's the problem. It goes back to that time. You're being plagued because of this disobedience that happened in the past. And so David goes to the Gibeonites and he goes, you know what? I want to apologize for what Saul did to you years ago. And God is saying, this is why there's a plague on the people today. So David said to the Gibeonites, what do you want us to do? They said, well, don't pay us money. That would have normally been the way they would handle it. Hey, just give us damages. They said, we don't want that. But the butcher, the guy that ended up doing this to us, wiping out our ancestors, our relatives, our family, we want his family. You deliver his family to us, and we're clean. We'll be fine. So David says, okay. And he found there were actually 8 descendants of Saul, but one of them was Mephibosheth. And so David spared the life of Mephibosheth because of his love for Jonathan. And then he takes these other guys, and if you read about it, it says in verse 8, the king took Armoni, he was the suit maker, and Mephibosheth. These guys were the sons of this Rizpah, who was one of Saul's concubines. Now, again, it's not the same Mephibosheth. It says right in the context that Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, he spared. This was another Mephibosheth. So 2 of Saul's kids by his concubine, and 5 sons of Michelle, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillel, the Meholathite. Now, it says Michelle, and you remember Michelle, Saul's daughter, who was married to David. It's probably not Michelle, because actually Adriel had 5 sons, but his 5 sons were by Michelle's sister, and so her name was Merib. And so this could be a textual thing. I hesitate to say that because it is in all the best manuscripts. Most of the commentators say it was probably Merib, or they make up things like, maybe Merib died, and so Michelle raised her kids, and thus in our version it says that Michelle, whom she brought up for Adriel, that brought up isn't really in the original. It just says she bore them. So she could have just been like a stepmother to them in some way, or it could just be the names are confused. But anyway, at any rate, 5 grandsons of Saul, 2 sons of Saul, they're all handed over to the Gibeonites. And verse 9, they hanged them on the hill before the Lord. The Gibeonites knew something about God. They had been pagans, but they had been influenced. And so here they must have been communing with the Lord. But it was also a typical superstition in those days, sometimes that when there was a plague that they felt was from God, if they found who was responsible, they would hang them and leave them hanging there until the plague subsided. So apparently they started doing this, and one of the ants, Rizpah, was trying to protect the bodies because it was raining and everything. And so David said, no, you don't need to do that. He went and got the bones of Saul, the bones of Jonathan, the bones of these 7 guys who were killed. And he put them all, gave them a decent burial, gathered those bones and buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan in the country of Benjamin, which is the tribe that Saul was from. Did all that the king commanded. And after that, God heeded the prayer for the land. God lifted the plague at that point. And then in the rest of this chapter, they go back and there were still Philistines kicking, still working. And so you see David and his servants going down, fighting against the Philistines. David grew faint. Again, probably the reason why the people didn't want him going to war anymore. But he was getting weak, and yet they were still having this battle. All of these giants who were relatives of Goliath were there, and God gave them the victory, and they all fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. And that chapter and most of the life of David is just about closed. Next week, we'll look at these last three chapters as we see this great psalm of praise that's a compilation of a lot of psalms that David had written. David's last words, and the whole thing's wrapped up. So we'll finish the book of 2 Samuel on next Wednesday night. Again, as we read these stories, it's tempting to just look at them as stories. And it's frankly, sometimes going through them, you just think, what's the point of this? And yet God has given us all Scripture to be applied to our lives. Now, if I'm just sitting here going, okay, what am I going to teach on this week? I think I'll teach on all these gory deaths. And guys' entrails being spilled. People being stoned, stabbed, hanging by their hair. This will be a really interesting Wednesday because, you know, people have been having a tough week. Been a long week. Sunday was a good day. Monday was a Monday. Tuesday was even worse. Wednesday just... oh, and I know people are just dragging themselves out to church on Wednesday night. They'd really feel better right now if they were sitting on a sofa with their feet propped up. So I think this Wednesday night, we're going to talk about some brutal deaths. I think we're going to tell them some stories that when they go home to sleep, they're going to have nightmares. Yeah, that's a good idea. No, I would never, in 1,000 years, decide to teach on this passage of Scripture, frankly. But it's why I believe in going through the Bible. It's why I think that's so important. Because God knows what we all need. I'll tell you something. Maybe what God is doing tonight is reminding us and letting us know what happens when we do things our own way. Maybe there's somebody here who's just been kind of considering doing something stupid, making a move that they really don't feel God wants them to make. You're just thinking of compromising in some way, or you're slacking off and not doing what God wants you to do. And so maybe the rest of us had to listen to these gory stories so that you can understand God is telling you right now, this doesn't work. Oh, you promote yourself? You start a rebellion? You do things that you know God doesn't want you to do and you think you're going to get away with it? No, it's going to cost you. God's saying, don't do that. And he's warning all of us. He's reminding each of us, you know, when you sin and you blow it, you mess up, I'll forgive your sin. He will. Make no mistake about it. God forgave David in his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. And yet, there's that reminder to each of us that it's still going to cost. God's forgiveness doesn't mean that he automatically reverses time in some way. And you can run back like Marty McFly and undo what you did. No, it's not going to happen. Sorry about that. If it happened, it happened. And you're going to deal with it. God will forgive you. He loves you. He doesn't want to beat you up or punish you. It's the natural consequence of making bad choices. And so I hope you're not thinking of making some bad choices. I hope you aren't. But in case you are, maybe God's just giving you a loving reminder tonight. Stay close to me. Do what I say. Do what I tell you to do in the way that I tell you to do it. Be faithful. Maybe for others of you, your life is kind of a mess. And reading these stories, you're going, you know what? I know where it started. I did this to myself. Thanks a lot, Dave. This doesn't make me feel any better. But you know what? There's a word from God for you as well. No matter how much you've messed up your life, no matter how much you've done that has done damage to those around you, you can start doing it right now. Oh, that's not going to take away some of the consequences of what you've done in the past, but it will keep you from consequences that will certainly come in the future if you continue to flagrantly violate what God is speaking to you. So the word is, hey, maybe you've already been a David. Maybe you've already experienced that pain. don't make it worse. David continued to make it worse, and it got worse and worse and worse for the rest of his life. Don't do that. Turn around now. But for others of you, you go, you know what? I've pretty much gotten away with everything I've ever done. It's amazing. It's never caught up to me. Well, don't tempt the Lord. Decide to learn from the example of others and just go, you know what? When I see my future, I want to know that it's going to be blessed, that God's hand will be on it. That's what I want. Maybe your past hasn't been that great, but what do you want your future to be? And God's saying, learn. Learn from other people's mistakes. Don't goof up your future. I can't do anything other than forgive you for what you've done in the past, but I can sure give you a new future. And that's what God wants us to know. He wants to remind us. The truth is, these gory stories, they're not as bad as what some of us have done. They're not as bad as some of the things that we've had to experience or that we've inflicted on others. But God loves us, and he wants to assure our future. And so he says, you don't have to do this. This could have been fixed 100 different places all along the way. It starts by telling the truth, and then by starting to obey and trust in God. And I believe that's the lesson that God has for each of us. David's story ended up pretty ugly in a lot of ways. But again, in a lot of ways not. God's still good. Jesus still called himself the Son of David, the root and offspring of David, the bright morning star in the last chapter of Revelation. God's grace is amazing. You've probably done a lot of damage. God can fix it. He'll bless. But if you continue to walk in rebellion, you're going to pay the price. And God wants you to know that lovingly but firmly. That's it. Get back on track. Be right with him. Live one day at a time for him, honestly and openly. And you can save yourself and other people a whole lot of pain in the process. Let's pray. God, whenever I have to teach on a passage like this, part of me feels like apologizing for it. Part of me wonders, I wonder who this is for tonight. I wonder who needed this. And Lord, I then find myself looking at my own life, my own heart, standing open before you and going, God, did I need this? Was this for me? Lord, I want to take that warning. I want to heed your voice. I want to stop if I'm going in any direction that leads to this kind of devastation. So God, help each of us to hear from you. Just to faithfully, Lord, live our lives walking with you, magnifying you, submitting to you. We pray this in Jesus' name.